Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church Haywards Heath. This week we are focusing in on the issue of racism and injustice, which has been reignited in our minds due to the events in the USA in recent days. As churches and as individuals, what should our response be when we see evidence of inequality in our society? And how do we pursue justice and law and order with a Christ-like attitude of grace and mercy?
My name is Graham Nichols.
And I am Mark Bentham.
And my name is Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. Well, today we are going to talk about race. We're specifically going to be talking about the issues that have gone on in America, in Minnesota, to do with the death of George Floyd. There's obviously been widespread protests and even riots and violence, and not just in the States, but also here in the UK, to do with race relations, the relationship between the police and the African-American community particularly. And I'm sure most people will be very aware of the situation, but for anyone who is not, or for people who are listening to this in the future, the situation essentially is that George Floyd, who was 46 years old, died or was killed after being arrested by police outside a shop in Minnesota, where he was allegedly using a fake bill to pay for something. The situation has become extremely inflammatory because for 8 minutes, an officer by the name of Derek Chauvin was kneeling on the neck of Mr. Floyd. And during that time, Mr. Floyd was protesting that he couldn't breathe and that he was basically pleading for his life. Footage of that scenario has been circulated widely, and there's been an incredibly strong reaction that is not only to do with this particular instance, but is mixed in with all kinds of history and context to do with police brutality and multiple fatalities of minorities over the past years, where there have been other suffocations, where there have been shootings of people who were not carrying weapons, who were not, as it turns out, doing anything criminal. And this has sparked, obviously, huge reaction in the media and in people's hearts and minds in the States and here in the UK. So it's definitely something that we want to hear from churches about. We want to hear our church leaders talking about. What does the Bible have to say about it? What is the situation in our churches? What kind of presuppositions do we have that we need to ask questions about? And just what we should generally, how we should approach this topic, because there's a lot being said about it on both sides. So that's what we're going to do today. I don't know if one of you wants to start us off perhaps with some ideas around the theology to do with this topic of race and what the Bible has to say about race, maybe.
Yeah, just in contexting it just a little bit more as well, I guess the what you said is true, that there's been a big reaction. And I think it is because it was like a lightning conductor for a lot of people's feelings about how the issue of racism hadn't been dealt with sufficiently well. And so it was kind of lightning conductor to that. I actually think there's a dynamic to do with lockdown that kicked in as well, which is you had quite a lot of people who were kind of frustrated with the state in general, and this was an issue on which they could kind of unite. So I think there was a degree of reaction that was related to that. It's not to say the issues are not there to do with racism and not genuinely felt, but I think there was a sort of dynamic to do with that, because they hadn't been allowed to gather. Lots of people hadn't been allowed to gather, and this was kind of an opportunity to gather and to protest and to march. So I think that may be, I mean, just practically speaking, some people do have more time on their hands. And so are able to really engage with the issue. So I think that probably amplified it. It's not to say there wasn't anything there, but I think it probably amplified it as well.
And I think
go on.
Well, I think that's right. And probably there's a sense as well, again, you know, not because it feels, particularly when you're in COVID-19, it's a situation you cannot control. Here's a situation that is clearly wrong and there's injustice, and it feels like we can do something about it. So I think that's kind of in part has ramped things up as well, possibly. That actually here's something we can now tackle, and it feels like we're able to take control as well. So I think that's playing into it, into the heightness of it as well, and how we're thinking about it and dealing with it.
Yeah. I mean, just to really to just sort of sketch in the biblical outlines, there's the creation principle, which is obviously men and women are created equal, but by definition, we're all created in the image of God, both men and women. So there's equality across the sexes in terms of our created dignity, but there's also equality throughout the human race because everyone's descended from Adam and Eve. So by default, they are all completely equal in terms of being made in God's image. There isn't superiority and inferiority. But as a result of the fall and of the dispersal at the Tower of Babel, there is the sovereign work of God in creation, in creating or rather facilitating nations, boundaries, differences, you know, tribes and so forth. And that process began and is described in the book of Genesis. And positively, the kind of ordering of nations is a gracious common grace gift of God in terms of maintaining order in the world, but it also at times is an expression of sin in the fear or the competition between nations. So I'm going to talk about the gospel and everything else, but do you want to add anything, Mark, in terms of that kind of the creation part of it, the creation and fall part of it?
No, I mean, I think that, I mean, there's nothing extra in that sense. I mean, at the end of the day, we are made in the image of God, and yes, we're all made in the image of God. Therefore, we've got to express that. And you know, the Bible doesn't distinguish in any way.
What's fascinating is that I read a really good article on it this morning, actually, on the Gospel Coalition website again. It basically Charles Darwin, even in the original title, which I hadn't quite realised, of his great work on the origin of species. He, because he has a different view about creation, he has a view about evolution, actually thinks there is differences between races, and in a sense he's the founder of modern racism. It's not a Christian view, racism. It actually derives from a sense that we have evolved differently and have different mental capacity and possibly different mental dignity. And it is quite an interesting irony that many people who are protesting will probably adopt the Darwin evolutionary thesis, perhaps not even realizing quite how it leads to racism more than not. So that's just a by the way point, but kind of connected with creation. And then in terms of new creation, that in the gospel, in people coming under the lordship of Christ and being saved, there's an equality there, which cuts across gender boundaries. No such thing as men and women anymore in terms of being children of God, and cuts across race, ethnic boundaries. There's no longer Jew or Gentile, Greek or barbarian, Scythian, slave or free. It cuts across class barriers as well. The gospel changes that. And then it is worth just doing the future to say that the new heavens and the new earth anticipates the arrival of people from every tribe, language, nation, tongue, so forth. So we should shape all our view of race by the fact that we're created, the fact that because of the fall and the bad fruit of the fall, there will be tensions between nations and tribes. Because of the gospel, we're united and there's a dignity in all of us, and because of where we're going in terms of the new heavens and new earth, there's an expectation of all nations, all tribes being represented there. So I think that's probably the outline of the kind of theology of it. The harder bit is kind of what that means in practice.
And I think in terms of, I think that's all of those in terms of race is crucial. And I guess just the only other kind of layer onto that is that God is a God of justice. So he hates injustice, and he hates the ways in which people have been oppressed and trampled on and marginalised because of the colour of their skin, or because of the sex that they are. So, or you know, so I think we've got to uphold that actually, as believers, you know, we God is a God of justice, and He's particularly concerned always for the weak, the vulnerable, those who are oppressed. And so in all of those kind of ways, we've got to uphold that actually there will be a day when there is an accounting. And I think that's important as believers, that not only as we hold to all are made in the image of God, but that actually God is a God of justice. So we should be concerned with justice and where there is injustice and oppression, because God is concerned about those. Just in the same way, you know, we should be concerned for the weak and the vulnerable and the widows. We should be concerned for those who are oppressed and marginalised in that way as well.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I think it's possible, isn't it, to split this kind of this case into two areas. One is the area of racism and injustice as a topic, and then there's the whole discussion around what actually happened on the ground that day, and the idea of this case becoming emblematic of what I previously said, race and injustice more generally. Mm. Obviously, the church has been. The Bible, I would say, has been used to both justify and undermine slavery. In the states in America, when slavery was obviously the norm, those people would have called themselves Christians, and accounts and stories of those times would have them justifying their actions, their slavery, their prejudice with biblical texts. And then you have John Newton over here in the UK, who is a slave trader on a ship, and eventually becomes to abolish slavery, or push for the abolishment of slavery in the UK on grounds to do with the Bible and Christian theology. So how do we approach now as Christians activism and speaking out where we see injustice, as you've just said, Mark? What is the role of the church right now in this situation, and more generally, when we see injustice? How should we be dealing with that?
It's a great question. I think it's really hard. I think there is a sense where it starts with empathy. I think often it's very hard for us, particularly if we're not in that same situation, to truly understand. I was reading something the other day, again on the Gospel Coalition, and you read the experience of a guy in the US who, you know, just you know, a pastor, black, and having the fear just of driving, and knowing that actually not if he gets stopped, but when he gets stopped, and the fact that he drives with, you know, his kids' car seats in the back, because he hopes that will kind of diffuse and make sure that his wedding ring is seen as he holds his hands on the steering wheel, or the fact that he talks about how he goes to a friend's house in another part of the city, and they've said, hey, you can borrow our swing set, leave it on the porch, just come by, pick it up. And he's thinking as he's doing that, he's in a white district, he's going to go pick up this swing, will people think I'm stealing? Now, I've never had to experience that, and as I hear that, I kind of just think, the sadness, the thought of just how horrible that must be to live with that kind of pressure. So I think we've got to empathise and educate ourselves, because it's really easy, particularly as a white bloke, you know, who lives in Britain, you know, who has many privileges, who's never had to think about, you know, the police are going to stop me because I'm white. You know, I've never had to think about if I'm doing this, will they're going to be stealing in those kind of ways, or how people will look at me, or how people walk the other side of the street because of the colour of my skin. And I think sometimes we can blind ourselves and just think that's just not the case. We were watching a film last night, and I recommend it, Remember the Titans. And it's a true story about when segregation ended and they brought together black and white in a school, and they played on the American football team together, and all the how they resolved that and the tensions. But there's a point where one of the team guys wants to go into just a diner. And the two of the team members who are like, again, just, no, we're not going to. They said, no, I'll be fine. You don't want to know these guys. They get in there and they're kicked out. Now, I've never experienced that, but that's a reality for some. And I think we've got to learn how to empathise and understand what's going on, because otherwise we just are blind to it. And you know, recognise in that our own prejudice and how we have responded and own up to that. But I think it starts with empathy and begin to feel for people and understand actually the horrificness of what that's like. So I think it starts there.
Yeah, I would really support that empathy and understanding. And it is true that it's different in the States. There are bad experiences in our own country, but I think they're at a different scale, different level. And the States is very varied as well, because it depends which city and which area. Whereas I think it's not quite the same here, that we didn't have segregation up until the 60s here. So I think the racism here that can be institutional, it can be to do with humour and sort of attitudes more than being quite as structural or embedded as it is in the States. So I think that there are differences to be aware of as well. And so they're not go chasing, sort of apologising and trying to deal with the things that are not happening here, because then it becomes a bit of an insult to the you know, police officers or whatever else, or, you know, the state generally. But yeah, no, it's really good to talk about.
That's very helpful. That's it. Yeah, I'm not suggesting that it is.
Yeah. But I read the same article and was sad and probably just slightly surprised about the level. I think because of American culture, where there are a number of famous black actors, I think we get a slightly false impression that it's totally cool and that there are no issues, because, you know, the entertainment media we're seeing is generally positive. And so I think that just masks what's going on underneath from, you know, people like this guy blogging and lots of other people. So yeah, that's helpful. Were you going to say something else, Mark?
I just think in terms of, in order to be able to empathize, it is to read well. And I think there's a really helpful reminder that actually what is true in the States isn't quite as true over here, although I'm sure there are some glimmers of that in certain parts. Yeah. But watch films that talk about it. Talk about the race issue. But there's also a book which we've been encouraged as church leaders, which is called We Need to Talk About Race by Ben Lindsay, who's from a British perspective and how race is impacted in the UK scene. So, you know, we do need to understand and kind of be familiar with actually what is happening and how people are treated in order that we can speak into it wisely and empathetically and biblically. So I think that's where we start. I think secondly, yep. I think, you know, in terms of our how we are, recognise our own prejudice, recognise how maybe we do things in the life of the church that actually are not helpful or wrong. You know, how do we encourage that greater ethnic diversity within the life of the church? Because we want it. You know, one of the most encouraging things I think we've seen in the life of Christchurch over the last 5 years is a greater ethnic diversity and those from different, you know, countries around the world coming and joining us. And it's brought a richness to our congregation. But, you know, how do we do that? How do we make it more open to those from different cultures and races and backgrounds? And it's probably a slightly different issue, but it's worth thinking and reflecting on.
Yeah. Just to complete the picture, I think, in terms of understanding, and it's a really tricky one to do with our past, because obviously the present is very straightforward to understand. You could say this behaviour happens, it's wrong. But part of the picture is, in the case of a number of nations, our slavery past, particularly in terms of the Afro-Caribbean people who ended up here for different reasons. Not always to do with slavery. Some were different waves of immigration. So there's that, but there's also our colonial past, which is not necessarily to do with slavery, but thinking about a number of races that are here in this country, Indian background people, of which there's a lot, and there is, you know, racism they experience, which is different. It's not so much connected with the history of slavery, but our kind of colonial history. And so you can't use the same tool for all of those, because they're different histories and different backgrounds. But you have to be aware of it to say it's not quite as simple as there's this issue where something's going wrong, that does have a history. I think the problem where churches go overboard and actually states are going overboard is trying to apologise for history or to to kind of, in a sense, make reparation for history, which I think is a great distraction. I think you can be aware and not apologise, not defend bad behaviour and just say, well, they were just people of their time. I think it is right to say, no, that was wrong, that was wrong. But I think getting too much into trying to somehow deal with it, it's just a hiding to nothing. I think it goes nowhere. I think it's much better to concentrate on the now and the future. So anyway, that's a big...
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, as a church, we've got to recognise that there are some things we've just got wrong, particularly the US, the Southern Church has got it wrong. And, you know, you can't hide behind that. So I don't think we want to kind of make excuses for it or justify what they did or how they did it. At the same time, though, we also recognise that, you know, they did get it wrong for a number of reasons, but there was also, they were also doing much good. It's kind of balancing those things out. I think particularly when you think about the UK scene, you know, there are, you know,
yes, but I think there's not apologising for being a white privileged male, because I think it just sets up a whole load of tensions, but rather actually say, how am I going to affirm everyone as made in God's image and remade in God's image, and how practically am I going to express that in the church? So there's a limited effect I can have on society. You know, I can vote for people that make the right decisions, I can lobby for the right decisions, but in the church we can have an effect, and we can challenge ourselves and say... If the church is not ethnically diverse, and particularly with sort of black and minority ethnic groups, if it's not, is there a reason? Is there a structural reason? Is there an attitude reason? Is there a cultural reason that's providing a barrier? And to make sure that none of those things exist, and that it would be as easy for the same person who is from a black or Indian subcontinent background to become an elder, a leader of the church, would be exactly the same process as for any other person. And to really ask ourselves, is that true? Or are there cultural barriers or other barriers?
And I think one of the difficulties with that is that often they're blind prejudices. So I'm not even aware that I'm seeing them, because you're brought up in a particular culture. So you may just even instinctively, not even aware of it, that you kind of are maybe fearful, or you cross the street. You don't even do it consciously, it's all kind of just done subconsciously, as it were. But actually, that's where we've got to be helping one another to just see the prejudices that we may be experiencing at this time, and confess them before the Lord, actually, where maybe we do have a slight racist heart, or we're slightly, you know, biased, or, you know, but actually, you know, before the Lord, confess that, and thinking about how that plays out in the life of the church as well.
And I think getting underneath issues as well, to say, just take one in society, to say it's, I think it's, you're five times more likely to lose a child if you're pregnant as a black woman than you are as a white woman. And you could say, well, that's outrageous, but you've got to get underneath it. I can't remember how many more times, you're X number more times likely to get stopped by the police in the UK if you're black than if you're white. Now, that's true, and you could just say, well, that's a problem. But it may be you need to get underneath that problem and say, actually, it's not an issue of prejudice. It's because in the health case, there's a predisposition towards certain health conditions which are not being recognised. And so the prejudice is kind of underneath that, or it's to do with deprivation. Or in the case of stopping, there is more crime committed by a particular group. But what's the reason why? Is there an educational reason? Is there a societal reason? Is there a hopelessness reason why it's happening? Rather than just try and deal with the problems, to say, well, you know, stop stopping black people, rather say, why is that happening? Is it a prejudice reason, or is it a reason that this something else is happening? And I think...
Oh, great, and wider, yeah.
Culture. Yeah, and I think you need societal. To get underneath that in the church as well and say, for lots of people, so if they're not progressing in the church... there may be a reason. You can't just say, well, let's just make it happen by some sort of positive discrimination, but rather say, let's really get underneath the why, and deal with it at that level, rather than just superficially, you know, do these token things. Does that make sense? Getting underneath, thinking deeply, and that's really hard, definitely. And especially not on Twitter. You just can't do it on Twitter.
Yeah, and I think one of the perhaps, do you think it is problematic to make cases emblematic?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, and particularly in the case of Black Lives Matter, as a statement, we would want to agree with it entirely. And that fits perfectly with our theology. But as an organisation, there are a number of overthrow of the state ideals and equality and diversity ideals that are not Christian at all. So what happens is an incident becomes emblematic, an organisation becomes emblematic or associated with that incident and the injustice, and purports to speak for everybody on the issue. So I think that's problematic.
Yeah.
And because it's so frenzied, there's not a lot of discussion around that.
For sure. And you, yeah, okay, that's really interesting. What about, I'd like to just slightly change angle for the last 5 minutes or so, and talk about grace and mercy. How does grace and mercy, Christian grace and mercy as defined in scripture, apply in this case both to the oppressed but also to the oppressor? And how does that apply to a criminal justice system more widely? How do we pursue justice in scenarios where it's right to, but not do it with vengeance, but with grace and mercy as Christians?
Yeah, it was a great question.
Answer that in 3 minutes.
I think to do with the gentleman in America and his colleagues, who I think are also on charges, there's a sort of an assumption from the world that he needs to be condemned. And I think that's not showing sufficient commitment to justice, actually. You know, we saw a video clip. It seems pretty obvious, but there's a process. We don't actually decide things by a social media vote as to whether people should go to prison. So that process needs to be really fair. There'll be so much pressure on it. But also that individual, you know, it's hard to say because I think the world hates him. And I think that individual deserves the grace and forgiveness of God as much as any other individual does. And I think that would be quite a hard thing to say on national radio just at the moment. So I might try and say it soon if I get the opportunity.
It's worth remembering, just jumping in there, that he is also made in the image of God. So we cast him as this kind of, in effect, devil person who's so evil. But actually, he's made in the image of God. So actually, even as someone who has committed potentially a horrific crime, you know, he's still valued and worthy of, you know, respect and honour as someone made in the image of God. Now, that doesn't mean I suddenly treat him, you know, that he's therefore let off. There's justice. He must face for the crimes as the process takes place, as Graham rightly says. But he's still made in the image of God. And it's easy to kind of forget that. And I think that's how we show grace and mercy. And we do offer, as we've talked before, between attitudinal forgiveness and transactional forgiveness. So, you know, we should be offering forgiveness. Now, it's not my place to offer him forgiveness, but, you know, in the sense of as Christ offered forgiveness to those who killed him as he was on the cross, but it's only as they repented on Pentecost did he then truly forgive them, the transaction takes place. And so I think we still should be, where we have been sinned against, particularly as believers, seek to offer forgiveness. That forgiveness is only totally transaction made right as they repent. But that's how I show grace. That's how I show mercy, in the way Christ showed mercy and grace to us. You know, that's how we're to treat people, even when they treat me horrifically, because Christ is the example of that. That's where grace and mercy and forgiveness is best expressed, isn't it? And so we mustn't lose sight of that. Now, we mustn't also think cheap forgiveness. That's where, you know, just come out and say, I forgive them. Doesn't matter. That's not forgiveness. It's truly forgiving, and particularly when someone's repentant and seen it right.
Yeah, I agree with that. And grace and mercy to those who perhaps are campaigning for, whether it's Black Lives Matter or some other organisation, who may not do it right, who may do things that hurt us or harm us, also being willing to forgive them, so not to perpetuate the idea of this sort of international conflict that's going to go on forever, but actually showing mercy and grace there too.
And final thing, I think we should be praying for this, praying as a church, praying individually for justice, for all folks involved. recognizing that each is valued, loved in the image of God. And how is the gospel being spoken into this situation? That is the one thing that can truly reconcile and brings true peace between men, both men internally, but also between men and God. So I think that's our greatest hope in this time. All other ways won't succeed, but the gospel can truly reconcile and bring peace, and does. That's the beauty of the church, that's Ephesians 2.
Absolutely. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Ordinary. Come back next week. We've got our first guest in a very long time joining us to talk about singleness during lockdown. See you next time.